Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of the CougCenter.com podcast. My name is Jeff Neusser, and I'm here with Brian Floyd. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Jeff.
How's it going?
Not too bad. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. And our listeners are really, really going to be doing okay when they listen to this, because we have a super special, mega awesome treat for everybody, because we were able to, unbelievably almost, score an interview with Chris Brown of smartfootball.com. And of course, Chris is going to listen to that, and he's going to be like, whatever, I'm not so special, except the rest of us who read his stuff know otherwise. Brian, maybe talk a little bit about what makes Chris so, I don't know, special is a weird word, but why do you enjoy his writing so much, and why is it such a favorite destination of people who really sort of consider themselves football geeks?
And Chris is like the quintessential internet star, like what we strive to be as far as analysis and stuff like that. And a lot of people look up to him. He's big in the whole blog sphere, internet thing. He's just really, really good at what he does. And it's not stat oriented. It's not numbers, anything like that. But he can take football and the concepts and the schemes, which may seem complicated for someone new to it, and make it all seem simple. He goes through and he can break down plays, he can break down schemes, he can break down philosophy, and he's got a bunch of really, really cool stories that go along with it. So he's just, like, his site's name is Smart Football, which may seem presumptuous, but he lives up to it, and it's an incredible resource for college football fans or fans of football in general, and the things he does are just outstanding.
Yeah, I believe that Chris started the site back in about 2003. I believe it was just sort of a basic WordPress site at first, and then it just sort of grew and evolved over time. And it's kind of like you said, you know, it's internet, sort of internet stardom. You know, I always like to refer to the internet as sort of a meritocracy. You know, it's like if you do great work, people will find you, and people will read it, and people will enjoy it. And Chris is sort of an example of that. You know, he started out with just sort of this humble site where, and Chris is, you know, he talks a little bit about that during the interview that we did. And, you know, he's a guy who he played the sport, coached the sport. So he kind of understands the sport, but he has a real gift for breaking it down and making it easily sort of digestible and understandable for the casual fan. There is, you know, I mean, it's, you do pick up some things the more you read it. There is a certain amount, and he talks about this during the interview as well, there is a certain amount of jargon that comes with that as well. But, you know, it's, he does a really excellent job of just making things understandable. If you're a football geek and you're like, in fact, if you're one of those people that when you read our site, you love, like when Brian does or I do, the you know, like the play breakdowns where we kind of give you screen captures to sort of explain what went on during a certain play, then you will really enjoy Chris's work if you don't read it, and you're really going to enjoy this interview because that is more or less what he does. Brian, maybe talk a little bit about like what it is about Chris that you think makes him sort of understandable, because, you know, he's going to talk a lot during this podcast, and what is it that sort of, what kind of gift does he have for making things easily understandable to the people who may not, you know, understand football down to its, you know, most core elements, you know, if you're not a hardcore play breaker downer?
He's just really, really good at what he does. This is a common theme throughout it, but the way that he writes things and the way that he breaks things down, it makes a complicated concept seem very simple. So he's giving you pictures, he's giving you diagrams, he's giving you videos, and then he's also explaining what goes on in a very easy to digest way. So he'll show you the action on the field and what's going on and all that, but then he'll also slow it down, he'll give you the diagrams of the play, he'll explain the concepts of the play, and it's all in plain English, basically. The problem you run into with football is that there's a lot of different terminology, and it varies from team to team, and it's all different. And he's kind of taking everything, putting it together, giving it back to the reader in a very easy to digest way, so you're not getting swamped down with, you know, confusing terms and complicated play concepts. So it really helps your understanding of the game and to be able to kind of figure out what's going on in front of you. So he'll show you a bunch of different concepts from the offense, and next time you go watch a game, you can say, oh, you know, I saw that on Smart Football, and, you know, I can see it happen in front of me now, and it all makes sense.
Yeah, and it's that ability that he has to make it all make sense pretty easily has gotten him noticed. You know, we talked about the internet meritocracy. Well, his site has grown from just sort of a little WordPress site into a pretty good looking site that got noticed by some people, such as Bill Simmons from Grantland.com. He's now doing pieces for Grantland during the fall, during football season. He's put together his own self-published book called The Essential Smart Football, which you can find on Amazon or any other pretty much reputable online bookseller. You can also get it on Kindle. We mentioned that during the interview as well. The Essential Smart Football, the book, is sort of a compilation of it's sort of like a best of album that a band might put out. You know, here's our greatest hits. Well, that's sort of what it is with Chris, although he sort of took a little different approach and said, you know, I'm going to pick different pieces from, you know, different parts of different things that I've done to sort of put together this, like it says, the Essential Smart Football. It covers a lot of different things within a lot of different philosophies and people that he's intrigued by, one of which is Mike Leach, which is one of the reasons why he agreed to come on and talk to us, is because he is so fascinated with the air raid of Mike Leach. But other parts too, he's kind of a football history geek, you know, especially in terms of the evolution of offenses and defenses and strategy on the field. And so he kind of took this broad, you know, subject and put it all together, pick different articles that he had written and put it together in a book. And so I can't recommend the book highly enough. It's super cheap. I think he mentions on the podcast like $2.99 on Amazon right now for Kindle. So there's really no excuse to not buy it, because you can have a Kindle app even on your computer and read it on your computer. So I can highly recommend that. I know Brian can too. And it's a great thing to read if you need sort of an introduction to football schemes, football concepts, etc. So let's go ahead and get on to the interview. You know, we originally planned to talk to him for about 30 minutes, maybe 45, about Mike Leach and the air raid and the evolution there. And even Mike Price, we talked to him about Mike Price and the one back spread, and, you know, Mike Bresky and kind of this stuff. And then what it ended up being was his answers were so good that we kind of ended up talking for a really long time. So rather than put it all to you in one giant hour plus podcast, what we're going to do is we're going to break it down into two parts. So today is part one. Part two should be coming your way later this week. And hopefully you'll enjoy these two parts as much as Brian and I did in interviewing him. So without further ado, here's Chris Brown. And with that, it is our pleasure to welcome in Chris Brown from smartfootball.com, who is the author of the site and also the author of the book, The Essential Smart Football, which you can find on Amazon.com. And I imagine Barnes & Noble and other reputable booksellers. Chris, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We appreciate it tremendously, mostly because just what I love about the work that you do and the site that you run, smartfootball.com, is that you take these concepts that most people would find sort of, you know, really complex and just almost impossible to understand. And I guess I would say even in the past, you know, football in a sense was kind of this, either you're part of the initiated or you're not. You know, coaches kind of took this, you know, either you're a player or a coach, or you're just a fan who doesn't get what's going on. And what I appreciate so much about your site is that you've sort of been a huge part of this kind of revolution that we've got in football right now, of breaking down that barrier between coach, player, and fan, so that kind of everybody understands what's going on. Maybe you can explain a little bit. I think your site goes back to about, I want to say like 2003. You know, explain the philosophy behind smart football, behind what you're doing, because I kind of think of it as showing the world that, you know, this ain't rocket science if you kind of understand a little bit what's going on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started to, I mean, the whole effort was just to write the kind of things that I wanted to be reading. And I just felt like there was not enough of this kind of analysis online or anywhere. I mean, and a lot of my early dialogues was really just aimed at coaches. You'd be surprised, a lot of coaches will go to clinics and then they'll, you know, some speaker will get up there, whether he's from a D1 school or the NFL or just a high school, and get up and talk about, you know, the Stafford dog, zone B, you know, Houston R, and then the coaches will come out and say, I don't know what that guy was talking about. And I really think there's, it is a rocket science, you know, if nothing else. Football is taught to 16-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids, 22-year-old kids, so it can't be that complicated. So, you know, it's a sport we all enjoy. So once you kind of get beyond the verbiage, I think is a big barrier for a lot of people, and someone that's just, you know, every industry needs its own sort of jargon. But once you get beyond that, the concepts are simple, and football really isn't about rocket science. And then hopefully from there, the other thing, the big driver for me, is there are a lot of fun stories that I think get obscured by the fact that if you don't really understand maybe even just some basics about what, you know, linemen do or linebackers do or what receivers do or how plays are called, and once you know even just a little bit, there's a whole underlying storylines of this coordinator versus that coordinator or how a scheme develops because of the talents of one player or maybe overcompensate for the lack of talents by some other player. Whereas, you know, I think we're used to the same kind of athlete coach storylines for the last, you know, 30, 40 years. So it's been fun to be part of that. You know, I think I also see myself as trying to sort of buttress what a lot of the stats guys do. And I think they've done a lot of great work of kind of analyzing the game mathematically, statistically, and with the probabilities. But unlike, say, a baseball, football is really hard to model. And so I just figure if I can get better information for those people who are smarter than me, and when they go off and do their stat analysis, they've got a little better picture of what's really happening on the field.
Kind of along the same lines that you have a fan that kind of sees the game on the surface and they want to know more, kind of how the schemes work, what's going on in front of them, kind of seeing the plays develop and stuff like that. How would you suggest kind of jumping into that and easing into that and, you know, starting to figure out what's going on beyond just ball goes here, ball goes there?
Well, I think the biggest revolution in that is that, you know, the DVR, I think, is your absolute best friend. And I think, you know, you just think about watching football, you know, obviously, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago, people were just listening to it on the radio or reading like a Grantland Rice telling you the play-by-play. And then you eventually got to just be able to watch a live broadcast or go to a game, but it was gone. Coaches watch film. That's how they learn. And I think you don't have to try to treat it like a coach does. And I think the point of watching football is to have fun with it. But you can watch a replay of a game or even a quarter or a couple plays of the game in, you know, 20 minutes. And I think you should watch a game of your favorite team just for fun. But if you are interested, go back on Sunday and watch, you know, your team's big victory, and just watch it and watch key plays over and over a few times. I mean, it doesn't take long, take 15, 20 minutes. And then just try to watch. I mean, I think the big thing is you try to look at, you know, what the offensive line is doing and then look at the linebackers. So if you can see it on the screen, you watch the safeties as well. The old saying, you know, when you first start watching film is, don't worry about where the ball's going. You'll know where it goes. You don't have to watch the ball. And once you just start watching the offensive line, you start seeing, oh, this guy's pulling guard, or he's stepping down, or the linebacker, look at the way that guy's feeling. And you'd be surprised how quickly it just starts to come together. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, you're watching a game on Thursday night or Saturday night, and you notice it in real time. You know, and again, for me, it's not about trying to turn it into a science or try to, you know, dissect the thing. It's just about finding another way to enjoy the game. And you know, if I watch a defensive back get burned and the camera zooms in on the corner and it's like, oh, you know, that poor guy, and they play like sad music for him. But really, because you've watched a couple of games, you realize it was the safety was supposed to roll over. It wasn't the corner's fault at all. And I think that just makes you a more informed fan. So whether you're going on a radio call-in show or a message board and voicing your opinion who should be benched, who should be starting, gives you a little more to work with.
So you mentioned the DVR, which obviously is a powerful tool. Do you, when you watch a game, do you typically just sort of watch it on a casual level and you know, basically watch the ball because that's how television has evolved, you know, over the years? Do you just sort of casually watch that and then rewatch the key plays later as you just described? Or do you actually, is there sort of a systematic way you watch the game when it's live? And if you do watch it a little differently, how could the average fan kind of apply that, especially if they're, say, like, you know, in the stadium where they don't have the benefit of whatever, you know, TV, DVR, et cetera, and want to maybe get a little bit more of a sense of what's happening as the play is developing versus just following the ball and cheering for a catch or a drop or whatever?
I think it totally depends on your mood, on what team you're watching, what game you're watching. And as I said, I mean, the great part about football is it's supposed to be fun and it can be enjoyed in a bunch of different ways. If I go to a game, there's a good chance that I'm more interested in having some drinks and talking with friends than I am sort of analyzing if the quarterback's checking to a fade pre-snap or if they're rolling the, you know, their quarters coverage down to like a zone blitz or something. You know, and if you're watching your favorite team, there's nothing wrong with just cheering for a catch or a great playoff tackle or something like that. I tend to watch NFL games more as just a fan, because I think those games, just me personally, I feel like if you're going to enjoy them, they're more enjoyable for, oh my God, Randy Moss is such an unbelievable receiver. Like, he just jumps over four guys, and that's kind of what you're marveling at, versus some of the scheme sort of diversity and how different the teams are. College, I think, is a little more fun for the schemes, because you'll watch a triple option team, you can watch a spread team, you can watch a, you know, on defense, watch a 3-3 stack team, a 3-4, 4-3, whatever. And you can kind of get into the cat and mouse, because you've seen how a team had to prepare all week for something completely different than what they saw the week before. So to me, it depends. You know, it also is just sort of how familiar I am with the system. If I watch Mike Leach, you know, Washington State, very, very familiar with what they do, can pretty much watch it and be like, oh, they call the mesh play. Oh, they call the tag off the mesh play. Just at this point now, it's pattern recognition. I'm pretty familiar with what Stanford does and what Oregon does. If I watch, you know, some team I don't watch very often, it might just be more about, you know, watching, you know, what good players they have or who they are. So it's really context specific. And I think if you really want to do your hardcore studying, I think that's better after the game, either on Sunday or Monday, or even the off season in the spring, when you kind of figure, oh, here's what they do. And then once you get to the games, it's all just comes second nature.
So digging a little deeper and going beyond watching games, one of my favorite pieces of yours is the one on the one back offense and the evolution of that, that morphed into the spread and all that. And it kind of traces back to Mike Price, to the point where we would jokingly call him the OG of the spread and things like that. So explain a little bit about Price and his influence on what we're seeing in the modern day, and how the one back kind of evolved and where it's gone to now at this point.
Yeah, I think the one back is huge. And actually, I mean, you've heard, I'm sure you're familiar, you know, Mike Leach has talked about that if he didn't sort of go down the BYU path, he would have gone down the one back Dennis Erickson three-step passing game framework, which is the Mike Price offense. It's the same one. And I think it's, you can't really understate how influential that was, and how even just interesting as it is, as sort of the, as I talked about, once you kind of understand a little bit of schemes, to follow the etymology of how these, they all developed. I mean, it all goes back to Jack Neumeyer, who was a high school coach at Granada Hills High School, who was running a one back offense in high school in the 70s before anybody else was. And then, you know, a local college coach named Jack Elway had a son who he thought should be playing in a pass-first offense, transferred into Granada Hills. Quarterback's name was John Elway. You know, set about a million high school records, running a one-back offense. Jack Elway thought it was such a good offense that he started running it himself. I think it – I want to say – I may have it wrong. Maybe San Jose State and a couple other places. And – I forget the exact lineage in front of me, but at some point Dennis Erickson sort of picked it up through Elway and Neumeyer and Price, along with Joe Tiller and a couple other guys, were part of the Erickson line, which obviously, you know, Erickson ran with success at Miami and Washington State and other places, and Joe Tiller went on to Purdue. And I think it's an extremely influential offense. It's interesting because, you know, obviously it was one back focus. So You had multiple receivers, you had the spread the field element. And I think it's an interesting offense, and I think what makes it sort of unique is that it started in high school and got developed in college, but I think its influence was very much from what was going on through the pro game, which was, you know, the Don Coryell Chargers adaptation of the Sid Gilman pro style offense, which was basically take the Sid Gilman pro offense and start going one back with it. And Joe Gibbs at the Washington Redskins is from that same family. So there's an extreme amount of overlap with these guys. And if you just take the Price version, I think it was the fact that they were able to go one back. They were extremely simple with the approach. I mean, it was very almost a, like, you know, if you think of the wing T or some of the old school offenses, it's all about, or it's like a triple option offense. You have like your base play, like a dive play. And then if they stop that, then you go to an outside run. And then if they stop that, you run like a bootleg. It was really series football, but from the spread. I mean, if they played deep, they throw the short hits to the outside. They came up, they would throw the option routes to the slots, Or if they came even further up, they'd throw it like, you know, four verticals over the top. And then if they backed out but jammed the receivers, they ran inside. And then, you know, Michael Black, I remember for playing on the team with Ryan Leaf and those guys, had over 1,000 yards. And just an extremely simple offense that was really devastating for defenses. And I also think the other reason is really relevant, especially the sort of the second half of the 90s, even early 2000s version of the Washington State offense was, you know, in the 90s, the big thing on defense were these eight-man fronts. Virginia Tech was doing it. You had the Arizona Desert Swarm, which was actually, I mean, literally it's almost mathematically impossible to run the ball from a two-back set against that old Arizona Desert Swarm defense. The problems come if you start spreading them out, and you know, Price was one of the first guys to really do that consistently, and they got the players to do it, and having sort of the freedom with those option routes, you know, was sort of a beautiful thing. And I think, I guess he's not real popular now, but Bobby Petrino's offense at even Arkansas is really, in a lot of ways, it's just was Mike Price's same old one-back offense. He also had some pro-style influence in there. But if you actually look at the plays, Arkansas is running the same playbook that Washington State was running in the late 90s.
Yeah, and it's really sort of fascinating to us because, you know, Washington State has sort of this tradition of flinging the ball around that even predates Mike Price, obviously. You know, you had Dennis Erickson, and then, you know, even earlier than that, Jim Walden. I mean, Jack Thompson throwing the ball. There's sort of this long tradition of doing it. And, you know, so it's not totally a shock that when Bill Moose decided to go try to find a coach, he went for the most prolific throwing football coach that was on the market when he hired Mike Leach. And, you know, the thing about Mike Leach is he brings this, you know, famed and almost fabled at this point air raid offense. You know, I mean, there aren't very many offenses that come with, you know, kind of the proper noun designation, right? You know, you got your West Coast offense, you've got, you know, maybe you might even throw run and shoot in there or something like that, but you got this air raid, and yet it seems to be sort of so effective. And you know, after reading a lot of the stuff that you've written about it, you know, it shares a lot of elements with that one back in the sense that, you know, simplistic elements, and not like simple as in, you know, bad, but just like uncomplicated to be able to repeat it and execute it. Maybe talk a little bit. Now, I realize you wrote like 10,000 words doing this in your air raid opus on your site, but, you know, maybe briefly for the casual fan who's listening to this, who hasn't really dived into the sort of the skeleton of the air raid, how would you describe it to sort of a neophyte, and maybe briefly explain also why you're so fascinated by it?
Sure. Well, I think probably to take the latter question, the reason I'm fascinated by it is, to your point on simplicity, when I think of the air raid, I'm always reminded, Warren Buffett's got a great quote about investing. It's a, you know, investing, and I may not get it exactly right, but investing is like most important things in life. They're simple, but not easy. And I think that's very true of good offenses. Like the air raid is extremely simple. It doesn't mean it's easy to do or easy to teach or certainly not easy to defend. But the simplicity kind of forms the core of it, which most good ideas are at core kind of just common sense. You know, I found it fascinating for a couple of reasons. I think my original fascination goes way back, and this is sort of, you know, when I was younger and even sort of when I was actually doing real coaching at that point, was this offense kind of percolated up from Kentucky, from the lower ranks, that they actually figured out a way where you could throw the ball against better opponents, more talented teams. You could chew up a lot of yards, a lot of points, and you didn't really need great players to do it. And it also wasn't really that complicated. I mean, it was not, you know, that the perception, you didn't have to have Dan Marino, you didn't have to run Dan Marino's playbook to throw the ball. I mean, anyone, you know, the old West Coast offense stuff was the dominant offense back in the 90s in the pros, and there was no secret that it took a long time to do. I mean, even the you know, it's changed a little bit now in the NFL, but the idea was, if you drafted a quarterback, you wanted him to sit for 2 years, and then he needed to play two more years, and then in, like, year five, he'd be good. And that's not really a luxury. Certainly high school coaches don't have, and college coaches don't have either. So the offense percolated up just as okay, here's something that might work. And obviously you have have talked about this, sort of the way the offense has spread through the lower ranks. More specifically, you know, I was fascinated. I think most people get drawn to the plays. I'll come back to what I think is, I now think is really the form is the core of the offense. But then you started focusing on the plays. When you really study football history and you study the history of football thought, there's really only so many ways to stretch a defense. And it all goes back to Sid Gilman, who I referenced earlier, who's sort of the, you know, if you've listened to Ron Jaworski, he calls him the father of the modern passing game, kind of a hyperbolic term, but I think it's pretty accurate. Really did kind of invent with the San Diego Chargers way back in the day, the finite number of ways to stretch a defense. I mean, really, you take a zone defense, you can really only stretch them horizontally or vertically. And he figured out the six or seven or five or six different ways to do that. And then he also really systematized having timing in your passing patterns. And it was stuff that, you know, Bill Walsh was a student of his and all those other guys. And it eventually BYU found a way to do it at the college level by taking those core ideas, which, I mean, you can write down as many plays as you want. You really end up in like one of these same five or six or seven buckets. And I think what BYU did and then what Mike Leach and Hal Mumming and those guys did is they said, well, why do I need 10 things to fall into each bucket? If I have one thing in each bucket, then I'm pretty much covered, and then I'll just get good at each of those buckets. And that's what they did. And they just had this tiny little package. I mean, Mummy used to have some hyperbole. He would say, oh, we had like five passing plays. It was really more like 15. But they actually enjoyed being super simple, which seems to be the opposite impulse of a lot of other coaches. So then once you see that, and you're able to watch the results in the field, and then, again, to our point earlier, part of the fun was just that you could watch them, and you knew exactly what they were doing. I'd watch enough games, and you're just like, well, here they're throwing 93H wheel again. You're throwing Y cross. And talking to Spencer Hall about this, once you get even a little bit of knowledge, maybe a little knowledge is dangerous, suddenly you watch the Texas Tech game and you're just like, wow, Mike Leach is calling the mesh play like 10 times in a row. And it actually in that way enhances your enjoyment. So it's seen it on a number of vectors where I enjoy it on really a coaching teaching thing. I thought it was a great concept to actually teach players. It's actually teachable. And then as a fan, you actually can have the pattern recognition that sort of enjoy what they're doing. And then you get into the game almost as much as a fan can to actually think through it, which I think makes you better if you go on to do coaching, because then you're actually thinking of it as a coach would, and sort of both strategy and how to best use your talent. And I guess that then brings me to then what I've over time come to really believe, not that it's the core of the offense, which is not the plays, it's really the whole sort of method to practicing it. The whole philosophy really is the same one as the Vince Lombardi one, where you run a few plays and you get really good at them. It's no different. The only difference is they want to throw it 50 times a game instead of running the old Green Bay Packers Lombardi sweep 50 times a game. So, and then from there, within the constraints of the college game, there's so little practice time. So they engineering their entire practice around throwing it maximum number of times. So you got those great drills, which now everybody does, you know, routes on air where they have five quarterbacks dropping back, each one throwing a pass. Common sense, Tom Mumming would talk about it. He's like, I don't know, when I was a receiver or when I would coach young receivers, they got really annoyed running a route and then not catching a ball. So I just wanted to make sure they catch a ball. And so therefore you put five quarterbacks dropping back at the same time. Well, lo and behold, you have a guy doing that for 3 years and every one of those guys gets reps versus a pro style sort of practice plan where the third string guy throws like 10 passes or something. It certainly gets no, you know, sort of in-game 7-on-7, 11-on-11 type reps. So, you know, adding it all up, it's just sort of been fun to watch them over the years. I think they've just done a great job, especially in sort of wayward places, using the talent they had on hand. And it's fun to me, too, as some of these guys have gone to different jobs to see how they install it, because I think that really puts the pressure to you as a coach to figure out what really is the essence of your offense, how do you teach it in a short period of time, and get good at it, and then adapt it to the players you have, which I think will be the fun part of watching Washington State this year, which may not translate into wins on the field, but to sort of see what they're doing, and to see how Mike Leach is like trying stuff out, but maybe it's working, maybe it's not, and how they're growing from that.
So that actually leads like right into what I was going to ask. But actually watching him do that drill with the five quarterbacks for the first time, there was a couple of us that were standing around watching, and everybody's jaw was just kind of on the floor watching this happen. There's balls flying everywhere, guys running everywhere. Leach is standing in the middle of the field yelling things. It was just like, I'd never seen anything like it before, and it was kind of incredible to watch all this going and trying not to get dizzy by all the action and trying to follow along with this stuff. And even he was saying, you know, he has to learn how to not follow the ball again and kind of get back into that coaching mode. So it was interesting. And it leads to kind of the transition that you just talked about. They installed the offense in about 3 days. It was really fast, kind of also another one of those incredible things to watch in the spring. And then just rep the living crap out of it for the next, you know, 4 weeks. Now we're in the fall camp, kind of back to the same deal again. What do you expect this transition to be like? Will they pick it up right away? Is it going to take some time into the season, or is the first year kind of hit or miss and maybe they'll get the system in and running like he wants it to after the season, or will we start to see some results right away?
I think probably a little of both. To go back on your thing, I was on the routes on there with the five quarterbacks at once, my first real introduction to that drill was when I was a high school quarterback. Back when Leach was still at Kentucky, I went to their Kentucky quarterback camp. I wasn't exactly being recruited or anything real highly, but the first time I had to do that drill, I thought it was the biggest pain in the ass, because you're driving back and you got a guy like in front of you and a guy behind you, and you're all throwing it, and it's which one to throw to. And I thought it's like the first time I did it, it was extremely disconcerting. But the logic of it is the other thing too. Not only do you maximize reps, but that's actually more like what the pocket's like anyway. It's busy. There's guys everywhere. You just got to get good at focusing on who your receiver is and going through the progression, which is, again, kind of the weird, bizarre, but common sense sort of brilliance of the whole offense and what Leach approaches. I think this year will be interesting to see. I think if you take a couple data points of how the offense will be in year one, I think a lot of it depends on, you know, what was there before. I think, you know, Leach and I know Holgorsen and some of the other guys have talked about when they first got to Texas Tech, they took over for Sonny Dykes, who'd been a pretty successful coach there, actually a very successful coach for a long time, but they had come from a running offense. I mean, it was very much a power off-tackle type offense. So, they didn't have a lot of receivers. They didn't have a quarterback, Cliff Kingsbury, who was a young guy at the time, he was like a sophomore. It took them a couple years to really get the offense where they wanted. Part of it was recruiting. Part of it was just the skills. The guys didn't come in with the skills to run routes, catch passes, et cetera. When Holgorsen went to Houston, leaving Texas Tech, he followed Art Briles, who had actually been at Texas Tech for a little while, though he doesn't run the air raid. He runs his own old system from Texas high school football, which he now runs at Baylor with great success, obviously. And the transition was not that great, because Art Briles had been teaching a pretty similar skills, similar process. Similarly, when Holgorsen went to Oklahoma State, one, he got lucky. He had some good players with Brandon Weeden, Justin Blackman, and Kendall Hunter, who's, you know, now at the San Francisco 49ers at running back. And they had been down the year before on offense, but 2 years before that, they averaged, I think, 250 yards rushing and passing. And Larry Fedora, who's now at North Carolina's head coach, had been the offensive coordinator at Oklahoma State. So even though they had kind of come off a bad year, the pieces were in place to have success. Holgorsen went to West Virginia and took over for, you know, what the remnants of what had been the Rich Rodriguez system, coached by some other guys. And I think it was a tougher transition for them this past year, much more inconsistent. They had some good players. They had, like, you know, the quarterback, Geno Smith. But the guys weren't really used to that kind of fast-paced, wide-open, spread-it-out-the-throw system. And a lot of they just didn't have as many guys with the techniques that they wanted. I think it's more interesting case of Washington State this year, because the past couple years they've been a throw-it-around team. So on the surface, it actually should be an easier transition for Leach this year than he had when he was at Texas Tech taking over for an off-tackle power team. You guys know better than me, they got a bunch of receivers. I got a number of sort of scat back type running backs. So, like, it looks like a lot of the pieces are the types of players he likes. You know, obviously the quarterback is going to be a big issue, though it seems like the Jeff Toole is developing well. I think on offense the big thing will be protection. I think you've seen some of the other area guys go a little more diverse with how they use their running backs and how they use their pass protection schemes. Leach, by the end at Texas Tech, was pretty much a one-back, six-man protection sort of guy the whole time. No tight ends. I mean, they would do stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong. They had some different formations, but the vast majority of the time it was just five linemen and one running back. And I think that was an area that really developed at Texas Tech, was that by the time they were making those great runs towards the end, they had a bunch of fourth and fifth year juniors and seniors who were like 335 pounds apiece, who were just like a wall. So I don't have any real clue as to how they'll be this year at Washington State. It seems, and I could be wrong, that the early reports are that they're not the expectation. It's still a work in progress. So I think that will be a big driver. I think if they get a lot of pressure and they don't have a lot of answers, because the other thing too is that, you know, they do build in, you know, they have the set routes, but they have hot routes and things like that. And that takes a while to get on the same page with. You know, you have it in the playbook, but can the quarterback and receiver make the read and do that at the same time? And if you add the fact that the line is still a work in progress, you saw that even with West Virginia. And again, they run a kind of a different system now, but the games that West Virginia lost last year, to use them as an example, they played Syracuse and got, they threw for like 350 yards, but they got sacked like eight or nine times and had a game where the line just couldn't pick up the blitzes, the running backs couldn't pick up the blitzes, and the quarterback's receivers weren't making the hot reads, and the whole thing just kind of like imploded on itself. So wouldn't shock me to see a couple games like that out of Washington State this year. Those kinks will get worked out, but I think it's probably unreasonable to – I fear that Washington State fans are going to be so amped up that if in game one they don't throw for 600 yards, it will be like, ah, oh, this offense doesn't work. But you know, I think like anything else, it takes time. And I think if I can make one point, I think Leach would say the same thing. The real beauty of the offense is not to bring in the plays. It's not to do the whole three-day install and then play in game one. The beauty of the offense is that you have such a core set of plays, you run so many reps, so that like in year three or year four, or you got a guy who's like a redshirt junior, that he's now good. And he's so much better than he would be in some other system because he's, for three or four years, he's been working on it. I know just as one example, I've heard a lot of the Texas Tech coaches over the years talk about a guy they had, Joel Filani, who's I want to say two-time All Big Ten wide receiver. And they talked about when he got to Texas Tech that he was literally horrible. Like, literally, they just said he was the worst receiver you'd ever seen. Like, the ball would, like, bounce off his face mask, and other guys were, like, making fun of him, and he had, like, no confidence. But over two and a half years, he just worked, you know, every spring and every summer, and he just, you know, catching balls and working out. And then suddenly, it just came together for him in, like, a spring practice or fall practice, and he went from being a guy that like the other players made fun of to he had like 1,400 yards. So I think I'll be very interested to watch how Washington State does this year, but I do think the finished product probably is a couple years away.
Well, that brings to a close part one of our interview with SmartFootball.com's Chris Brown. Hope you enjoyed it. If you're looking forward to part two, we'll have that for you later this week, and we'll talk about things like what attributes does the ideal Mike Leach QB have, and how does Jeff Toole fit in with that? And we'll also talk a little bit about Marquise Wilson and what a guy like that can do for a Mike Leach offense. And then we'll also talk a little defense. We'll talk about Mike Bresky and his 3-4/4-3/multiple system that he runs, and what we really mean when we say over and under concepts, because that's kind of a central tenet of the defense that he runs. So hopefully we will catch you back here later this week for part two. You can find out exactly when that publishes by subscribing to the Coug Center podcast on iTunes. If you just search Coug Center, you'll be able to find us. So thanks a lot, and hopefully we'll see you later this week.